You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Dr. Richard Cytok is the author of Synesthesia, The Man Who Tasted Shapes, The Neurological Side of Neuropsychology, and with David M. Eagleman, the Montaigne Medal winner, Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain on of Synesthesia, all published by the MIT Press. His new book, also published by the MIT Press, is Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age, Coping with Digital Distraction and Sensory Overload. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Cytok.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. It's nice to talk with you again.
You know, this book starts with a very interesting, I think, deliberate allusion to the beginning of 2001, A Space Odyssey. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. Oh,
okay, that's... I'm so glad to hear that.
The early epoch of human beings.
We see the early epoch of human beings, and this is a bit beyond moonwalker time. This is at the dawn of we're close to the dawn of civilization, where human beings are gathering in groups and learning to live together as social animals.
And exactly.
You explain how their brains are developing. And it's fascinating to read this because as you explain how the Stone Age brains are being developed by the activities during the Stone Age, we here in the Screen Age can see, oh my God, that has implications for us. And that was a masterful piece of writing. What led you to begin the book with this kind of introduction?
Well, I wanted to, because I'm talking about the Stone Age. First of all, most people never think about their brains, and they don't think about how they think. And so there are very few people like me, I'm trained in neurology and neuropsychology, that actually think this way about how do we think and what's going on with our brains. And so I wanted to tell a story, really. I didn't want to just give facts. That's so dry and boring. But to tell a story of these early people and how they're interacting in a day as the sun comes up and they leave their cave and they go to the edge of the sea to collect mussels and clams and creatures in the shallow pools. Of the social interactions among them, among the women, and then what are the men doing who are hunting and they're doing other kinds of things, and how the synergy among these two different branches of the community are in harmony with one another. And so, you know, people talk about, the brain is rational, reason. And it's like, well, yes, it is, but more importantly, it's social. And the social aspect is what is so important. And I think this is what the book really tries to emphasize as we're claiming that, oh my God, I'm addicted to my phone. It's like, well, why are you addicted to your phone? You know, why do you spend hours on TikTok and Instagram and all that? And what are the social implications of that?
You know, one of the things that you make, points that you make straight out that I had never thought of, was that the brain is a limited resource. You only have so much energy. And once you discuss that, it's kind of a revelation because I must admit, when I do an interview like this conversation that I'm having with you now, often afterwards, I will need to take a nap.
Well, you know, you're quite right. I think what's going to really surprise, if not shock, most of your listeners is to learn that the brain has a fixed level of energy available to it. And no amount of diet, exercise, supplements, or Sudoku puzzles is ever going to be able to increase that. And so when you're asking, and one of the most energy intensive things you can ask it to do is switch its focus of intention from A to B, to B to A, to C to D to E. When you ask it to shift its attention as if like the flight of a flitting bird, that is the most energy intensive thing you can ask it to do.
Which is to say that multitasking is not actually a thing. And that's
well, it's not. I mean, this has been proved. My guy Clifford Nass from Stanford showed this decades ago, is that multitasking is a loser's game. And even but here's the thing. Even when he showed, his subjects, his students, how terribly they performed at multitasking, they denied it and said, oh, no, I can do this. I'm good at this. I can do three or four things at once. And you can't, I mean, the perfect example of this is the famous Oscars debacle, which announced the wrong winner for the best picture show. And, there are two people on either side of the stage with their envelopes lined up from PricewaterhouseCoopers. And Andrew Cunanan, who was known as a very heavy Twitter person. So Emma Stone won her award and she went off on one side of the stage. And just as she was leaving, he tweeted a picture of her. And that's when he should have been discarding the previous envelope. And so instead, he had the wrong envelope lined up. And what that shows is that working memory cannot do two things at once. It's simply impossible. And so that's why we had that debacle at the Oscars, because he was tweeting when he should have been queuing up the next envelope, and so he made a huge mistake.
Now, one of the things that this book makes perfectly clear is that, and you write extensively about this, the visual aspect, visual information we get, on one hand, it's just a fraction of how much information our digital devices can spit at us, yet the amount that we do get takes up 73% of, our cognitive abilities to process. And in fact, what you write is that our eyes are part of our brains. Talk about the implications of that in terms of the effects of the visual display devices that with which we assault ourselves.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question. What? Talk about what?
The effect of, because our brains are mostly consumed by visual cues, talk about the effect of that digital devices have on the brains by virtue of the fact that they can consume our entire attention.
Right, that our bandwidth of attention is so limited, and so we're bombarded by all these screens, whether they're held close to our face or advertisements all over the street. There's a thing now that these people like J.C. Decoe who do outdoor advertising and talk about this as street furniture. And so you walk along and you see these kiosks that are showing advertisements and things, and they're very, very bright. So the brightness of them is one problem, but just the sheer amount of them is another. And they are far more than we are able to handle. I mean, my Verizon fiber optic network shoots information into me at I don't know, 78 million bits a second, but my brain can only handle about 160. And so listening to one person speak takes up about half our bandwidth. And so then trying to listen to two people speak at you at the same time, it just about overwhelms it. And we've all had this experience. And how can you listen to two people talk at you at the same time? It's really, really hard. Why? Because your cognitive bandwidth is being exhausted. And so if two people speaking at you can do this, then what do you think all these screens and texts, notifications, alerts, etc., what do you think they're doing to you? It's asking too much.
You talk about something called a virtual autism.
Oh, yes, yes. So
talk to us what you mean by that phrase. How does it happen, and what does it mean, imply for visual devices?
This is one of the most misunderstood things I've ever said, because when you say, I say virtual autism, everybody reacts hysterically, says, oh, autism, autism, you know, as if I'm talking about developmental autism. My kid's going to be autistic. No, the autism spectrum disorder is a developmental disorder, which features a severe lack of communication ability. But when you have young people, especially, it can happen at any age, but particularly among young people, when they have a heavy screen exposure, they develop symptoms that are similar to developmental autism. And by that, I mean is that they don't look you in the eye. They refuse to look you in the eye. There's no communication. If you're lucky to get a grunt out of them, if you get any kind of communication at all, and they are completely sucked into this world of the screen. I remember a young boy, one of my nephews had a birthday party, and his colleagues were there, and there was a young boy who had a game pad and an external battery, which told you how heavily he was involved in this. And the mother said, say hi to Richard. He said, I said so, without looking at me. You know, this is virtual autism, which is autistic-like symptoms developed by heavy screen exposure. And this was first noticed in an orphanage in Romania, in which just kids that had only just 4 hours a day of excessive screen exposure started developing these symptoms. And so not just the people in Romania, but others well around the United States have shown that once you take the screens away, these symptoms develop. I had a father from as far away as Iran that said, oh, our son won't look at me. He won't respond when we call his name. He doesn't recognize his sister, etc. And he read a column I wrote on Psychology Today. And then he wrote back and said, once we took the screens away, within a month, he was now running to me and hugging me and recognizing his sister and all that. So there you are. I don't know how much more evidence you need. And yet you still have tech boosters who say, oh, this is all overblown. You're just being a scaremonger. Oh, there's these screens and iPads, iPhones, potty seats, activity seats they're wonderful. They're an unalloyed asset. And that's not the case.
You know, one of the things I think that's very important about this is that this is a book. It's not a video presentation. It's not a series of lectures. It's an actual book. And you make this point early on that reading is like a form of meditation.
Yes. So many people can't read long-form fiction. They're so used to reading a screen at a time. And one way to improve your concentration and your attention span is to read something that's longer than a screen at a time. It develops your muscles. your intellectual muscles.
And that's one of the things I think that this book makes really clear, is that our brain is very much like a muscle in that it requires exercise. And the kind of exercise that builds up the brain is exercise, social interaction in the real world, face-to-face interaction with other human beings. And one of the things that you talk about that was really fascinating was a discussion of the number of muscles in the face and the way that a smile can be generated, whether it's a smile that you impose on yourself or a smile that comes to you spontaneously. Talk about the importance of the muscles in the face and our reaction and ability to read those muscles and how that's impacted by your device.
Well, you know that in terms of a smile, it only takes two muscles, one to close the mouth and the other to open the mouth. But we actually have 43 muscles in the face, and it's not always apparent of... I talk about a genuine smile, the so-called Duchenne smile, in which the lips turn up, the corners of the mouth turn up, the eyes crinkle, etc., versus a fake smile, which that never happens. I mean, I wrote a piece about Ted Cruz and why his face was so awful, because he was making all these expressions that weren't natural. You know, one other thing, you know, children learn to read faces much earlier than they learn how to speak. Okay. And so infants are really clever individuals, and they are reading your face. They are reading your emotional reaction to them. And so these muscles, or these 45 muscles in the face, are mostly controlled by emotion, and we have no control over them, no voluntary control over them, unless you want to pretend that we're posing for a toothpaste commercial and baring our teeth and saying hi, you know. So facial expression is one of the more important parts of body language, and people learn how to do it from a very, very early age, and there's no way to fake it. You cannot fake it till you make it. If you can't fake it, you're not going to make it. So,
one of the great horror movies of years past was a movie called Jaws, and then we've always been terrified of sharks. You write that selfies kill more people than sharks.
They do. Well, the thing that terrified us most about the Jaws was not the shark, but John Williams. Boom, 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 boom. He that composer knew how to excite emotion in us with his music. And so that's sort of a synesthetic thing, isn't it? That the boom, 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 boom makes you think, oh my God. So yes, but selfies do kill more people than sharks do per year.
One thing about music I think that's interesting is that it's a really high bandwidth form of communication. Two notes, like as you say, there's what, two notes in that whole Jaws theme, but it conveys a very complex universe of pursuit and
emotion and terror. Yes.
And it conveys things that could not be conveyed with language or visually either.
Yeah, that you cannot convey any other way. Yeah. And again, I there's a paper I wrote long ago about aphasia and Maurice Ravel, the French composer, where he had a stroke and then he lost his ability to express music. What I wrote about is how language and music are two different kind of communicative symptoms based in different hemispheres of the brain. But you're quite right that music is tremendously evocative of emotion. Yeah. But to get back to selfies killing more people than sharks, yeah, there have been people who have, you know, that posed themselves in front of an oncoming train or holding a hand grenade or jumping from ropes and there's a high on life channel where these three teenagers decided they would go over a waterfall in a barrel and died. So people do astonishingly foolish things while trying to take a selfie and impress, I don't know, whoever their audience is or whoever they think their audience is. I mean, it's really quite sad.
Definitely. A very firm and uncomprehensible version of the dangers of screen infatuation. I'd like to talk about what I think is one of the cores of this book is the brain energy cost of these distractions. Talk about what our brain energy is and how it is like consumed by the images on the screen that are essentially useless and meaningless to us.
Well, I mean, a few people think about it in terms of this, but I mean, as a neurologist, and I have friends who are also neurosurgeons and engineering backgrounds, the engineers always think in terms of energy cost. What does it cost in terms of energy, in terms of glucose or ATP molecules or whatever the fuel of the brain is at the moment? What does it cost to do a certain activity? And so I try to make quite clear, and I think this is what will shock your listeners, is that the brain has a very fixed energy cost and we can't do anything to increase it. And so we have to learn how to live within its limits. As I said, you know, the speaking with listening to one person at a time takes up half our available bandwidth. Trying to listen to two people at once is nigh impossible because it's already exceeding the bandwidth that we have available. So energy costs was a big concern as I wrote this book. I'm trying to get people to understand that you can't outwit it, but so we have to learn how to live with it. And so then I make suggestions instead. So how do we live within the fixed energy costs that our brains give us? Because don't forget, our Stone Age brains have not changed since the Stone Age. And technology and society has moved far ahead, but evolution doesn't match that. And so we're left with this organ that's really struggling. I think, you know, we've accommodated all sorts of things before. I remember when the automobile came out, people thought, oh, 30 miles an hour. Oh, human bodies were not meant for such speeds. And the airplane came out. Oh, no, how can we possibly come with? And we've adapted all that. But I think we finally reached a point where we can't adapt anymore because we're not adapting to physical things in the world. We're adapting to this screen culture and digital culture that is miles beyond us.
One of the things you say, I think that's really powerful, is that the psychologists and scientists have developed the applications and things we see on the screen in a manner to take advantage of the infirmary, you know, the weaknesses of the way the brain processes information. Talk about the kind of studies that are consulted by the people who design things to make us keep on clicking.
Oh, exactly. You know, all the big technology companies know that they're only 1,440 seconds in a day, and they compete fiercely for our eyeballs. They have hired teams of psychologists who understand exactly how positive intermittent reinforcement works, and they design their applications to keep us hooked on their site and make it difficult for us to leave the site. So, you know, we're at the mercy of these forces that are battling against our free will, if you will.
Well, one of the things I thought was really interesting was that when you swipe something with your hand, especially when children do this, it changes the perception of the hand. As
exactly.
Talk about that happened and what that implies.
Well, this is something that Arko Gosch in Switzerland discovered. He's a psychologist there. Is that he found that when you swipe the screen, you end up remapping the representation of the hand area in the sensory cortex. Now, this in itself isn't terribly new, because, for example, we know that, like, violinists, for example, when there is, as violinists get more and more proficient, the hand area represented by the bowing string gets bigger and bigger in the cortex. So that the more you exercise a particularly sensory skill, the more it's going to occupy your sensory cortex. But this was a surprise that screen swipes do this. Now, the problem with understanding what that means is that, you know, we don't swipe for, unlike knitting, for example, where you're doing one thing, swipes don't mean the same thing. So you're swiping for different reasons and contexts. And so it's really hard to pin this out. But the research is clear is that swiping your phone will remap the sensory cortex of your hand region. The other thing that was really astonishing about Arko Gosch's research is that he found that people even swiped their phones while they were supposedly asleep. I mean, it was like, wow.
Now, you mentioned a phrase earlier, positive reinforcement.
Positive intermediate reinforcement.
Think of
Pavlov's dogs. You ring a bell and you feed it a hunk of meat and the dog salivates. And eventually when you ring the bell, the dog will salivate on cue. That's reinforcement. So now positive intermittent reinforcement is just like a jackpot. So you put your money in and you pull the lever and you get, I don't know, nothing. And you do it again, you get nothing. And eventually you get a hit. And so you start getting small hits and then medium-sized hits. And then eventually the jackpot. So the fact that you're not getting a reward all the time, this is what we mean by intermittent reinforcement. And so the fact that you can't tell when you're going to get a reward makes your addiction to it all the stronger. And you just have to set to watch people at casinos who are just plunging away at slot machines with buckets of coins in their laps, is that they can't stop. So, and this is what the infinite scroll is. So you're scrolling on your phone and, oh, there's something good, interesting or humorous or whatever, you've gotten a hit. So you keep scrolling, and you're waiting for another hit. Oh, I got another hit. Yeah, great. And then, oh, this is a big hit. Oh, I really want to know about this. Let me just, you know, check this out. Da, 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 da. And so you just keep scrolling. You can't stop. And that's what the infinite scroll is, because there is never any end to your scrolling, is there? There's never any point that says, okay, you've reached the bottom. No, it's always, there's more, there is more, there is more. And that's what goads you on to wanting to keep scrolling and to keep asking for more reinforcement.
And that's essentially addiction. You write, What happens in the minds of heavy screen checkers is qualitatively no different from what happens in the minds of any addict. Society does not yet disparage screen dependency and distraction the way it does drug addiction, although Ms. Valica's prosecution suggests we may be getting there. Talk about the idea of addiction in the digital age to digital devices.
Well, you know, these are what we call behavioral addictions. And so there are physical addictions, you know, nicotine, cocaine, whatever drug you want to take. But then there are behavioral addictions, which are patterns of behavior, which are also addictive. And it's been shown many, many times by a great deal of research, is that the levels of dopamine and other chemicals in the brain that happen during these addictions are just the same as they are during physical addictions. So behavioral addictions are really no different in kind than physical addictions are, you know, alcohol, drugs, etc.
Dopamine plays a big part in this book. What part does it play in terms of the brain's response to digital devices as opposed to the brain's response to actions in the real world, interactions, and particularly social interactions?
Well, you know, dopamine is released in response to pleasure and reward. So, I call dopamine is produced in a tiny cluster of cells in the midbrain, and yet they project all over the place. So that's why I call dopamine that has a passport to every nook and cranny in the brain. And it's just too simplistic to say that dopamine is only involved with reward and pleasure, because it's involved in so many other aspects of biology, from blood pressure control to mood and so on. So I think your question was really about addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's certainly involved in addiction. It's involved in addiction that involves mostly narcotic type agents. It's been shown that it's active in virtual addictions like those involved with the screen.
Now you introduced a number of new words, at least to me, and one of them you introduced was technoference. What is technoference?
Oh my goodness, did I say technoference? Okay. So, well, technoference is just the interference of technology in our lives. So it was this, you know, it won't leave us alone. It insists on bursting in on our attention and saying, hey, look at me, pay attention to me. And of course, this is what is so exhausting. I mean, think of yourself in a airport lounge or a doctor's waiting room, and you're just trying to sit there and, I don't know, maybe even read the newspaper on your iPad and all that. And yet there's a monitor on the wall with the news feed crawling along that says, look at me, pay attention to me. And you can't turn it off. It's like, how can you not look at this thing? It's like it wants to grab you by the throat and say, hey, stupid, don't just sit there. Look at me, pay attention to me. It's really hard to resist because it's all over the place.
Now, you write that if this book has a running theme, it is the conflict of Stone Age brains in the screen age and how to protect ourselves from being hijacked and biohacked by powerful forces that have anything but our best interests at heart.
Well, Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, they don't care about us whatsoever. They just want to make money, and they're going to make money off of our eyeballs. And all these tech companies want to hijack our eyeballs. As I said, there's only 1,440 minutes in a day, and they compete for each one relentlessly. So, we are being hijacked by these companies. And it seems so easy to be led into this. It's like, oh, this is free. Oh, I'll sign up. Yeah. Well, as Marshall McLuhan said years ago, if something is free, then the product being sold is almost certainly you. So, we pay for quote free in terms of giving up our own independence and self-actualization.
You talk about the import and the impact of flickering lights. And so talk about that in terms of the screen age.
Well, if flickering lights, there's a thing called reflex epilepsy. And so if you were driving by a strand of trees or watching the old-fashioned cathode ray TVs, certain sensitive individuals would have epilepsy. And people who did this would have it quite often when they were watching screens, because the flicker, the on and off flicker, triggered the seizures. Well, now today, screens are much more stable and they don't have that flicker. But you'll notice that when you watch Netflix for certain programs, there's a warning beforehand that says this program features certain strobing effects that might affect certain sensitive individuals. So what they're referring to is individuals with reflex epilepsy. And again, I'm sure your listeners will be shocked to realize to under to know that yes, there's this category of individuals for whom flickering light is really dangerous. And that's reflex epilepsy.
You also talk quite a bit about FOMO, fear of missing out. Talk about how that impacts our social abilities to interact with one another.
Well, FOMO, fear of missing out, it sidetracks us down so many things that we otherwise would never do. Because if I don't do the if I don't do this, I'm going to be missing out. And so you look at your friends, so-called friend, when your friends, they're not your real friends, your 1,000 friends on Facebook, Instagram, etc. And so you're looking at all the stuff that they're doing and the wonderful life that they're projecting, this artificial life of look at me, here's how fabulous I am. And you're thinking, oh my God, I could be doing that. Oh, but I'm not, and I'm a loser, and I feel so sad. And so FOMO really has bad effects on a lot of people because they're so, I don't know, addicted to needing to belong and belong to what? To this artificial group of people that they really don't know in person. It's quite sad.
One of the things I found most disturbing and sad was the impact of screens on the growing mind. Talk about how, introducing screens early, and there are people who argue for this, who say, oh, this is
Oh, I
educational
know.
baby
Yeah.
Einstein.
It's not at all. No. I think putting an iPad in front of an infant or a toddler is a form of child abuse, because what you're doing is blocking their central vision. Look at a baby crawling along the floor, okay? Putting everything in its mouth. It's having a visual tactile apprenticeship with the world. It's discovering what the world around him or her is. And so when you block that and put an iPad in front of them, you're depriving them of that experience. Also, you know, color vision doesn't develop until about age 4. So, you know, the young brain is undergoing a huge amount of change and development. And it keeps developing until about the age of 25, which is why I think, you know, there's no reason to have screens and iPhones in front of kids of any kind. Here in DC, we have one of the Waldorf schools, and their philosophy is they don't even bother with screens, with phones until they're about 11 years old. And the hardest thing is to convince the parents. The kids love it, but the parents like, oh, no, I need to be in contact with all the... Well, if you need to be in contact, then call the school office and we'll have them talk to you. But you don't need them to be tethered to you all the time. And this notion that you must be tethered to your phone, whether you're a student or a worker or who must be answerable to his or her boss constantly, what a source of anxiety that is. You know, it's such a relief to be, I'll tell you from firsthand experience, what a relief it is to be unreachable. I love it, you know. Oh, you want me? Well, I'm a public figure. There's many ways to reach me. I'll get back with you tomorrow. If it's an emergency, what kind of emergency could it possibly be? You know, what is so important that you need to be reachable every second of the day? Nothing. And so once you realize that and accept that, your life will be so much easier. And I say this to parents, and I'll let go. Why do you need to be in touch with your child constantly? Back off, mama, you know? And for the same for the child, it's a good thing for you to be unavailable. My God, when I grew up, we got out of school, we rode our bikes. All they knew is that we need to be home in time for dinner. That's it. Where we went, what we did, who we were with, they couldn't have cared less. And neither did we. And we were so much more mature for it.
You read about online, what you call online and offline thinking and the development of empathy. Talk about what you mean by online and offline thinking.
I'm not quite sure what you're referring to there.
Online thinking was this idea of engaging with the world as it comes at you, and offline is your processing what might happen in the past or
so,
the future.
Yeah, so online is your immediate engagement with the world. Okay, you're engaged now with people, persons, and things. But an offline is when you sort of recess back and you're thinking about, in your imagination, about the experiences you've had, what they've meant to you, what you wish to do in the future about them, how you might have handled things differently. So there are just two different modes of thinking. The one is the immediate engagement, and the other is the more reflective. And I think that it behooves us to engage in much more reflective thinking than we do now, because staring at a screen is not reflective thinking. It's being sucked into this vortex of now, 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 now. So put it face down. And my advice for, you know, how do I detox myself from this kind of stuff? Well, the first thing is to put the phone down. Can you put it face down on the table or wherever, or far away on the other side of the room, And how long can you stand it before you have to go pick it up and check it again? Because many people are going to discover to their horror that they can't stand it and they've got to go pick it up and check it. I mean, you know, you wake up in the morning, the first thing you do is you check your phone. You go to bed at night, the last thing you do is you check your phone. And one of the first stops of detoxing is to stop those habits.
This is something that I think that's really interesting that you write about, is that many of us who are clearly, we understand we're addicted to our phones, yet we're ashamed of that and try to quash it within ourselves. Talk about that kind of conflict within us that the use of these digital devices creates. It's the kind of shame of addiction.
That's the tug of war that many people say, I'm addicted to my phone. I know I'm addicted. And yet they can't or won't do anything about it. It's almost like Chekhov, you know, where the three sisters say, oh, if only we go to Moscow, if only we go to Moscow. And the question that Chekhov says is, well, why don't you just go? And the answer is that they can't. And that's his whole point, is that unless you can change things yourself, nothing is ever going to change. And that was Chekhov's brilliant point. And I think we could apply Chekhov to addiction, is that if you can't back off on your phone, then who else is going to do it for you? You can't expect any external force to pry your fingers away from the phone. You have to decide, okay, I've had enough. I want to change my life. How do I change my life? Well, here are the steps I can take. You know, you can start by putting it face down for a while. You can put it in another room. You can stop using it as your alarm clock. Buy an alarm clock that wakes you up, or put the phone on the other side of the room. Just step by step, you know, it's not an easy cold turkey. It's a step-by-step thing where you decide, I can't do this anymore. And you just look at how much time every day you spend looking at your phone on TikTok, on Instagram, this, that, and the other. How many hours does that add up to? It's shocking. I mean, people are looking at their phones for about like 4 or 5 hours a day. And that's, you know, we're only awake so many hours. And so, like, you're wasting all your time on this thing. I'm not wasting it. Well, really? Well, what does it give you? How much meaning to your life does it give you to be following Instagram and TikTok? Is this really what you want to do with your life? So those are the kinds of questions I would ask.
Yeah, it's an example of, you're not going to look back on the past and say, boy, I remember that time I was checking my phone. What fun that was.
Yeah, we never think back about, oh, what a great Instagram thing that was. No, we think about the experiences that we had. I was with so-and-so. I was hiking. I was swimming. I was doing this, the other. Those are the kinds of things that we think about. I was with Nana and Grandma. You know, we had a great time. Those are the kind of pleasant memories that make us smile. Not like, here's what I was doing with my phone, you know. And so I think all that is meaningless, mostly meaningless.
You talk about Jaron Lanier, who wrote an article called 10 Arguments for Deleting Your Social Media Account.
Oh, Jaron Lanier, yeah.
Talk about his approach to this, Matt.
Well, you know, he's one of the fathers of the internet. You know, he came out with that, which is, I think, quite brilliant, which says, you know, we created this whole internet thing and look how toxic it is. And so he gives us 10 reasons why we should just say, the hell with it. Stop it. I've had enough. I'm not going to do this anymore. So I'm thoroughly in agreement with him that that the internet, I mean, the internet is wonderful, okay? And I am not a Luddite. I think the technology that we have is simply fantastic. And yet we have to balance it. We have to say, okay, it can do all these things. I can call up this information at my fingertips. That's assuming, of course, that I know what information I want. People talk about connecting the dots. Well, if you don't have a deep well of background information, then you have no dots to connect. So what the hell are you going to connect? So Jaron Laron said, yeah, we've just got to stop this. And I'm totally in agreement with him.
Your book is such a powerful argument for this, to like step back from where we are, just to drop it and step back. I'd like you to talk about creating a book and the importance of doing the writing. That's something that you can only do by yourself, sitting down, one typing one word after the other. Talk about creating this as a book and making that decision.
Well, I had the idea about digital distractions many years ago. The book took me 5 years to write. Writing for me is a kind of meditation. I love to write. When I retired from neurology, my emphasis went from, how do you treat a certain kind of thing, disease, towards, what is nervous tissue? What is the mind? What is I went I switched to what are kind of puzzles. And so to me, writing is a kind of physical meditation. My mind goes in a space that I really can't describe. I only know that one of my teachers said that disturbing a writer is like waking a dreamer from a dream. You cannot go back to it. So sometimes I read what I've written, and I'm astonished, and I think, who wrote this? I wrote this? Where was I at this time? It's quite spectacular, really. But I mean, so but I love to write, and so I've done this book. I'm currently working on another book with a colleague of mine, which is a suspense murder thriller. And I have a memoir about myself and my father in the 1950s. I mean, so I'm always full of ideas, and it's just what I do. Wind me up and let me go.
Talk about writing a novel.
Well, I've written nonfiction for such a long time that writing a nonfiction is really, really different and difficult. I tried a while ago. And my agent said, no. He said that so many of his nonfiction readers had tried to write fiction and just gave up because it was too difficult. But I'm now collaborating. I'm a good collaborator. I love collaborating, as I did with David Eagleman on Wednesday's Indigo Blue. So I'm now collaborating with Barbara Billman, who is a playwright, who a successful playwright, and we're working on this suspense thriller. Several years ago at the Southampton Writers Conference, we were standing under the eaves of a building after lunch because it was raining, and I had my recorder with me. And in an hour, we dictated the entire plot of this suspense murder thriller and thing. But things happened, and some years passed, and so now we have revisited that. So it's just the idea of being creative. And the fact that I can be creative and I can be creative with other people. And that is so thrilling. And so that's why I write, because it's so exciting to do so, of putting forth an idea out there, and you struggle with it. And it's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle, you know? And then you figure it out and you think, ah, yes, yes. And now we move on to the next beat and the next scene and off we go. I don't know how else to explain it other than that it is just so enjoyable a thing to do. I love it. I love it to death. And if I couldn't do it, I think I would drop dead.
The new book by Richard Cytok is Your Stone Age Brain in the Screen Age, Coping with Digital Distraction and Sensory Overload. Thank you for joining me, Richard.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.